How have you not seen this?
Welcome back to How Have You Not Seen This. As always, it's me, your host, Dustin Meadows. Today, I am joined by my guest co-host, Mike Kolar.
Hey, how's it going?
And we are joined by our guest, Michael Myers.
Hello.
And Tyler Sonicson.
Hello.
Making his first appearance on the podcast. Pretty excited about that.
I think the people deserve it.
Oh, absolutely. They've been clamoring for it. Yeah, bring this guy on. You know. we just watched Lethal Weapon. And it's a great movie. It's one of the movies to go to as far as like the tropes of buddy cop action movies, those sorts of things, right up there with movies like 48 Hours, Die Hard, as far as action tropes are concerned. Pretty important movie, pretty big movie in terms of what where it stands in Mel Gibson and Danny Glover's respective careers. Made so much money that they made four of them. Two of them were actually good. So with that being said... Michael, how have you not seen this?
I saw Lethal Weapon 4 and I thought the series was at that point, so I just never went back and watched the rest of it.
Oh man, you thought wrong. Tyler, how have you not seen this?
I mean, it took me, honestly, until a few months ago to see Beverly Hills Cop for the first time.
Oh, wow.
It took me until the age of 27, about, to see 48 Hours for the first time.
Okay.
So, I was born in 1983, right in the midst of the buddy cop cliche manufacturing gauntlet, as you might call it. And I don't know, I just never got around to watching the... You know, Netflix was a big reason I finally saw Beverly Hills Cop. I didn't realize that's where the... We run this department by the book. Like,
yeah.
Because I grew up on all the stuff that referred to that stuff, like McBain on The Simpsons.
Of course.
Like, McBain, we work by the book here. And then McBain shoots the book and the giant hole in the wall. I don't know. I feel like all the cliches were there, but I never just physically sat down and watched Lethal Weapon.
Okay.
It's kind of crazy to me that, like, that... Because now, if you look at that, that's just a silly movie.
Yeah.
But people probably walked out of that theater like, that was the most badass thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it was the first... Like, one of those first ones to really do that.
Yeah.
So it's certainly cool to go back to. It's also... well, we'll go ahead and get to this right now before... it escapes me. Not a very politically correct movie.
No, not at all.
Several times.
You could also argue that it might have been one of like the last major like hit movies of the pre-PC era.
Yeah,
The PC era, I mean, people say it kicked off really like when Clinton entered office, which was early 1993.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you had like, this was, but I feel like movies and stuff were moving in that direction by the late 80s.
Yeah, definitely. Well, with stuff like Tipper Gore and the PRMC, absolutely.
Yeah, that was the year before. That was like 85, 86. So this movie was made kind of like on the heels of the PRMC. And I hadn't even thought about that connection, but yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And there, I mean, that push.
Who wants to quote Mel Gibson's lines from this movie?
Who
wants to quote them?
There's a couple.
Get off me, fag.
There's a point.
You misquoted his hateful line. He says when they're outside a house during one scene in the movie, very, I guess now legendary scene from this movie, where they are approaching a house to question someone. There's like a prostitute lives there, I guess.
Prostitute who witnessed the murder.
Yeah,
and all the neighborhood kids love.
Yeah.
And the house just blows up and Danny Glover's crawling all over Mel Gibson, or should I say Murtaugh, if we're staying with characters.
Yeah, Murtaugh.
Murtaugh's climbing over all over...
he's trying to put him out.
Yeah, he's on fire.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Like, it's not like he's just doing it. Like, he's trying
there
to save his partner.
So the symbolism is even greater when
he's flaming.
Yes, exactly. But then he says, "What are you, a fag?" And we actually had to, when we were just watching it now, we're watching it on VHS. You didn't mention that.
The director's cut on VHS, too.
Yeah, director's cut on VHS, which I purchased for 50 cents at, I believe, some thrift store in Maryville, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually had to rewind it to just hear that line again. Did he really just say, yeah, I guess in 87 people weren't just like, oh, I'm going to take to Twitter with cancel Mel Gibson hashtag.
Yeah.
Maybe that was part of the director's cut you want to throw back in.
Yeah.
But I mean, and that's the thing though, like, it's like Tyler said, we had to rewind it to watch. Like, it's subtle enough. I genuinely, that could have been in the version I've seen countless times, and I just didn't remember it.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a part later where Mel Gibson is being tortured by Al Leong, who pops up in this kind of role in all kinds of movies. Actually, he was just in Big Trouble in Little China, which we watched the other night on tour. He's in Die Hard. He's the Chinese terrorist there.
He gets blown up good in this. He walks out onto the roof and
just
Bruce Willis in a hand cannon.
Yep, just that's laid
pretty,
out.
It's a pretty like integral death scene in Die Hard. I think.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Oh, and killed with an ice cream cone in Last Action Hero by Arnold Schwarzenegger too. Yeah, he just gets killed by a lot of Hollywood guys. But so the scene, Al Leong's character walks up to do like some electroshock water torture to Mel Gibson, and Mel Gibson. Either one of these is terrible. He says either who's the chink or who's the chin.
Yeah.
Like, that's what he says. And it's just like, hey, Gary Busey. Like, and Al Leong isn't offended by that either. It's just like, he's got me dead to rights. It's what I am. Like,
we're also 5 minutes and 40 seconds into the podcast, and that's the first mention of Gary Busey.
Yeah. But, oh man, I feel like there was one more, too. And I'm completely blanking on it. It was like
very subtle.
It was like an offhanded subtle line that Mel Gibson had, and I can't remember what it was. Huh?
Was it when he fucked Danny Glover's 17-year-old daughter?
No, but it was something equally terrible. So let's talk about some of the other things here. Gary Busey. Let's talk about him since we just brought him up. This is honestly one of my favorite Gary Busey roles.
It's great.
This is the quintessential Gary Busey role, I think.
Yeah. Like, I think Gary Busey is at his best when he's playing this kind of character. So this and Under Siege.
You mean a madman?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I forgot about Under Siege.
He's much more restrained in this, I feel.
That's
like.
Fair.
Like, especially in that final fight with Riggs, he looks sane.
Yeah.
Like, next to Mel Gibson. Like, he's just calm and controlled. Mel Gibson is making Three Stooges noises and bicycle kicking him across the yard.
He's like, pulling, like, some Kung Lao type shit.
Yeah.
He just lost his wife, man. Give him a break.
He lost his wife, he threw something at the TV, and he tries to eat a bullet every night.
Those Visine tears streaming down Mel Gibson's face.
Yeah.
You learn a lot about Riggs in those moments where, you know, he just hates seeing people happy on television.
Yeah.
To the point that he destroys his own television thinking that solves the problem.
Yeah. Like, it's not even, not even like a Hallmark movie or something. It's Family Feud.
Yeah.
Like, it's a game show that sets
fuck
him off.
Fuck Richard Dawson.
Yeah. you even said earlier, so it was like what, like his wife was killed on a game show or something?
She was killed, and it's clarified when they spell that out in the scene after that, I think, when...
Yeah,
right
with the station psychiatrist.
About, yeah, where she's explaining to the chief, who doesn't play nearly as much of a role as you expect him to, because he seems kind of like a dick.
Yeah.
And he's like, it's like the chief, not like the chief in Beverly Hills Cop, who's like very integral to
very
that
present.
Whole, very present throughout the thing, constantly being like, we do things by the book here. Oh, you're going to drive me crazy. You're going to drive me crazy. Like, you know, he just shows up in that one scene and then assigns them. It's like, all right, you guys are partners now. And then he's gone.
His role is much more prevalent in the later installations of the series.
Oh, okay.
But also, it's funny because now this is the second time in the podcast that guy has come up. Because the only other time that I've seen him in a movie was in Demolition Man, where he plays Sylvester Stallone's captain. Oh, Demolition Man is so good.
Well, maybe we should have watched that instead.
No, we've already done Demolition Man.
Oh, have you? Okay.
Oh, please. I did Demolition Man as soon as I realized, oh, people haven't seen this?
Mm-hmm. That was what inspired the podcast.
Oh, I love Demolition Man so much.
Yeah, I mentioned that we were going to do this to some friends, and they actually said the line to me. They said, how have you not seen that?
Yeah.
As soon as I said, I haven't seen Lethal Weapon. I've just never been in front of a television while it was playing.
Well, or in this we case, rectified it.
Yeah, and this was on VHS on a very dinky old television, so that's pretty much the way it was meant originally to be shown on home video.
There's at least two differences I noticed in the director's cut version, so let's talk about that since we watched the director's cut.
Can I just say one thing about the director's cut, too?
Yes.
On the back of the box, it was like, the big thing was that there was over 7 minutes more.
And that's
all that was added was
six of those minutes was the introductory scene to Riggs.
Okay. Yeah. But yeah, the whole box also, you know, on the back of the box it gives you the synopsis of the movie. And the whole thing on the director's cut box is explaining why this is a better version than the other version
that
you can buy in stores. It's like, don't let the original fool you. This has 7 extra minutes.
Yeah, don't let
explaining Riggs, explaining the darkness of Riggs or something like that.
Yeah,
like,
don't let the critically acclaimed, financially successful version fool you. That movie's a real piece of dog shit.
It doesn't have the scene where Riggs... Maybe you should introduce the scene.
Yeah, Richard Donner seems to have a lot of that, because Superman 2, there's the Richard Donner cut of it as well.
Oh, okay.
Because his vision was compromised or whatever. So the difference between this and the theatrical cut, Riggs is initially introduced at length, like more than just seeing like the shot of him getting up in his trailer home and looking at his dog and throwing a beer bottle and smoking a cigarette. First thing, or no, he wakes up with a cigarette, and it's implied that he fell asleep a minute ago smoking. Riggs is introduced to us during a school shooting. Like, a sniper has taken up position in one of the higher floors of an elementary school and is taking pot shots at a playground. Riggs puts a cigarette in his mouth, asks the guy about the shooter, is like, oh, is he methodical or whatever? He's like, no, he's just shooting at random. And Riggs says, oh, if he's shooting at random, he can't hit me then.
Yeah.
And, like, just walks up the steps, past the monkey bars, and just holds his gun, yells something, gets shot at, like, 8 times, then waits on the sniper to reveal himself again, and then just empties a clip into the guy.
Yeah.
Like, not, like, a single shot, which would have been sufficient, because we see the first shot goes through the guy's brains. But then he just unload 15 more bullets.
That's a death wish right there.
Yeah, well, then he drops out the clip, pops in another one, cocks it, and is ready, as if the 15 previous bullets didn't get the job done.
He's taking the kids, man.
Maybe the drama, maybe the Lethal Weapon dramaturg didn't, like... They said, no, that is just pushing it a little bit too far. We have to take the scene out of the movie.
Well, yeah.
It's kind of a useless scene, because later you see how good of a shot he is when he's just pounding around with...
Yeah, with Murtaugh, absolutely. Yeah, and then in the original introductory scene when he's doing the drug deal at the Christmas tree lot, and he takes out 3 of the 4 guys, and then, like, he keeps yelling at them to shoot through him, then finally, like, disarms the guy and headbutts him, and then just speaks in tongues at him or whatever, before the other cops pull him away and tell him he's not worth it, like...
It's establishing the fact that he's apparently crazy.
Yeah,
or is he?
He has like a death wish that he is. I think after that is when we see the scene where he like comes close to blowing his brains out.
Yeah. That's right after.
Yeah.
Well, and that Christmas tree lot scene is played right after the school shooting scene, practically.
Yeah. That's so a busy day for Rick.
So it's like it's like the director's cut. Like one of those scenes could have been dropped in favor of the other, and it makes sense in the theatrical cut. Like I like that schoolyard scene.
Doesn't make any...
But yeah, it makes no sense if they left the theatrical scene that follows after that.
That's a good point. So I also think I mentioned this while we were watching it just now. But in 1987, the idea that someone's like shooting up a school seems so fantastically like completely unbelievable,
just improbable.
That would never happen. So they just shot that, and there was no question about it. Now that happens once a week. Like,
yeah, exactly.
27 years later, it's like we're at the point now where we see like a sniper in a school. We're just like, oh, it must be a Tuesday.
Yeah,
and that's terrifying.
Well, and like not even
is Lethal Weapon to blame.
The director's cut is.
Yeah.
Well, and then like not a decade later, you got the Basketball Diaries with Leonardo DiCaprio, where he plays Jim Carroll.
It's another movie I've never seen, but also I understand that's based off of Jim Carroll's like. Poetry and diaries.
It's not quite a biopic.
Yeah, it's just like his sign of poetic fantasy of shooting up his school.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's the scene exactly. Like the movie came under a lot of scrutiny for that. Was banned in a lot of places. Like they pushed for like a harder rating and everything for it because of that. So like just the shift in 10 years, like about the public perception of gun violence, is really weird to see.
Which is, it's strange because I think gun violence in a lot of ways, at least in the movies, was kind of the golden age of movie gun violence in the 1980s. Lethal Weapon was kind of, and that between like the cliche establishing movies like, you know, Beverly Hills Cop, 48 Hours, Die Hard was probably like one of the best gun movies of all time.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Talk about like completely unbelievable, just sort of like fantasy gunplay.
Yeah.
Just the kind of stuff that Bruce Willis pulls off in Die Hard. Not even like a trained marksman could do any of the stuff that he does. It's like I've talked to people, I don't own any guns, but I've talked to people who do, and like they say that, for example, like a gun in each hand.
Yeah, that's very impractical.
Yeah, if you have two-handed gunplay, maybe you can hit like the side of a building firing both guns. Like you're not gonna hit, like maybe you'll get lucky with one of them and like hit what you're trying to shoot, but there's no way you're going to get, like, more than one.
Yeah, well, that's what I love about John Woo movies, is, like, every time somebody's going in with dual guns, like, very rarely are they hitting people. Like, you just see things around the people they're shooting at, like, exploding and
it's
getting bullet holes in them.
And in slow motion.
Yeah.
Diving and rolling. And
but Riggs was also able to roll, like, some sort of lead pipe.
Yeah.
And shoot while he was doing it.
Yeah,
hit his mark every single time.
Well, he's practiced.
Yeah, he's special forces.
Yeah.
He has a death wish too.
He's a tough. Yeah.
What he even said, like, there's that that moment with Murtaugh right after he has dinner with his family, where he tells him, like, "I was in the shit and I killed a guy from 1,000 paces." He's like, "Killing's the only thing I was ever good at. Killing and rolling, because that roll was pretty good."
And waking up naked in a trailer.
Yeah, waking up naked and not having
television destruction.
Yeah, not having your cigarette ash on you while you're asleep with a lit one.
That's probably why he lives in a trailer, because he has to buy a new TV.
Yeah, I spent like 3 months rent on TVs alone. That's why I had to move out on the beach. the other scene in the director's cut is when he picks up a prostitute to come back to his house and watch The Three Stooges with him.
Yeah, see, I thought that was going to be like, that was going to establish some sort of thing, like, this is how he gets the lead on what's going on.
Yeah, I thought
but
that
really,
too.
Really, it's just like, oh, Riggs is a lonely guy that pays prostitutes to watch The Three Stooges.
I was like, yeah.
And he says the whoop, 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 like, to the prostitute.
Yeah, like,
she's,
like, she's not familiar with The Three Stooges.
Also, she seems into it.
Yeah. She's, she's like, seriously?
Hey, I don't know, if a prostitute one night?
Yeah.
$100 to just watch anything. I mean, we have to think about this, you know, this practically from the prostitute standpoint. She doesn't have to bang this incredibly attractive 1987 man. By the standard of 1987, he's the hottest guy in the world. This is Mel Gibson.
We're talking about.
But, you know, she gets into a car and he hands her $100. Like, I wanted to see, like, the conversation. Like, the part of me was really curious. Maybe they filmed it and they just, like, weren't even allowed to put it in the director's cut. They're just like, all right, this is just Mel Gibson talking to a prostitute while they're watching The Three Stooges.
Yeah.
Or Three Stooges copyright, like, prevented them
from actually showing the scene.
Or Mel Gibson just calls sex The Three Stooges.
What, The Three Stooges? Larry, Curly, and Mel.
He has three testicles. Yeah, okay. Larry has three testicles.
It's such a graphic sex scene that they had to
Also, we have to assume that Mel Gibson has bought another TV.
He actually does. Right after the Christmas tree lot scene, he's carrying a box in, and he even says to his dog, "Here we go, brand new 13-inch color TV."
That's ironically what we just watched it on. I have a 13-inch color TV.
So you can watch all the reruns of Lassie on it.
I think I got mine for free, and Mel Gibson probably spent hundreds on that.
Yeah.
1987.
Well, and you didn't have to get a new TV because you shot it or whatever, or threw a brick into it. Because Family Feud was on.
Also,
reminded you of your dead wife.
He has bricks just sitting around his
trailer,
too. the old
TV brick.
Just in case I see a family win too much money on Family Feud. Just in case.
Can never be that family.
Heartbreaking. Especially, like, watching this now, there's some things I'd never caught before. They mention it again, the idea of Riggs pretending to be crazy to draw a pension, which is actually genius.
Yeah,
and I almost want to watch a movie where that's the premise, where it's just a guy, like, pretending to be crazy, kind of like I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry, except not offensive and the worst thing in the world,
not homophobic.
Preaching a message of equality and having Rob Schneider play a Japanese priest, complete with slanted eyes and buck teeth.
Dude, fuck Rob Schneider.
Oh, seriously. Man, fuck them for making that movie. Jesus Christ.
I just wanted the excuse to say fuck Rob Schneider.
Oh, hey, we welcome that. But that happened on the Demolition Man episode 2. Because seriously, he's the worst.
Rob Schneider's probably listening right now.
He's crying.
I'm
going to
get those guys.
He's like booking a labor
work in this town.
What's he going to do? Play another racist caricature in an Adam Sandler movie for the 12th time?
I'll show him this time. This time I'll really make him laugh.
Oh, well, what haven't I done? Oh, looks like blackface is coming to Rob Schneider. I think that's the only one he hasn't done at this point. He's played Hawaiian Japanese, European, just all these terrible stereotypes.
And he was also in the Longest Yard. Which to this
day, he was in The Longest Yard?
Yeah,
I didn't see that.
He showed up as this like random dude, in the, just because it's an Adam Sandler movie.
Of course.
I think, I don't know what the deal was there. But that's one of the first movies I remember going to the theater and seeing and becoming so viscerally angry at how stupid it was.
Yeah.
Like, how bad it was. Like, you know, there's certain movies that are so bad and they're dumb, and you're just like, ha ha ha, but I'm like, this is kind of, I felt similarly about Nacho Libre, but just not as like viscerally angry at it. Like, I was just disappointed. I was like, that could have been funnier. With The Longest Yard, I was like, that could have been not homophobic, that could have been not racist, that could have not involved Rob Schneider.
Yep.
Like, you know, and
any number of ways out for it.
Yeah. So that's going to be a recurring... I feel like you need to make sure to weave that into every episode of your podcast from now on.
Oh, I'm sure we can.
Maybe Rob Schneider was in Lethal Weapon as an extra. We don't know.
He wrote Lethal Weapon.
Under the pen name.
He only wrote the fag and chin part.
Yes!
Jesus.
What were we just talking about? Rob Schneider got us off topic because he's an asshole.
Oh, man. Fuck.
The TV. Yeah.
TV were there
the
somewhere.
The prostitute,
watching. Three
Stooges,
watching.
The racial insensitivity.
Yep.
Something about it, you couldn't get away with that. You couldn't get away with it today. No.
Oh, I remember now. I was talking about the things that I'd never noticed before.
Oh, right.
The idea of him pretending to be psychotic to draw pension.
Oh, that's Catch-22. I mean,
yeah.
you read Catch-22, I imagine. Like,
I've actually never read it.
How have you never read this?
Because books are for fucking nerds. That's how.
Well, reading's wrong, and I don't want to be right.
Precisely.
But yeah, Catch-22 is essentially like about that exact idea where someone tries to pretend they're crazy to get out of the army.
Yeah, to get a Section 8.
Yeah, to get a Section 8, but the...
Like Ted Nugent?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, yeah, Ted Nugent, like, shat himself and, like, didn't bathe for days to get out of the army.
That's a true patriot, right?
And
there.
Then, oh, yeah, and then calls people draft dodgers and that they're whoring and pimping out the country.
Oh, man.
Also,
right, so, okay,
he's
so you're
fucking
on a,
nuts.
Yeah, all right, so you have a... Okay, so let's say you're Mel Gibson, and you got one bullet left,
so
and you have Ted Nugent or Rob Schneider, like, both in your sights.
Ted Nugent?
Yeah, Ted Nugent.
Not myself, clearly.
If you're in a place that has both of those in close proximity, what have you done in your life?
Rob Schneider is stupid, but ultimately, at the end of the day, he's harmless. People buy into Ted Nugent's bullshit.
Rob Schneider didn't write Wang Dang Sweet Poontang. Ted Nugent did. Yeah. So.
Rob Schneider also, at least to my knowledge, didn't fuck a 14-year-old and write a song about it.
I don't know. Have you ever heard his album?
Rob Schneider's?
Yeah.
Rob Schneider fucks a 14-year-old.
Yeah. No, I think that's the Jimmy Page album. Oh, the other thing I remember now.
This is taking such a good turn, this conversation.
Oh, this happens sometimes.
Yeah. No, I was just
very much the nature
saying,
of
like,
the podcast.
The whole concept of the Catch-22 is like, but if you're trying to actively get out of the army, that means that you're not crazy. So that's the Catch-22.
Yeah.
And I remember speaking of, wasn't Rob Schneider in that movie, The Benchwarmers?
Yes.
No, not The Benchwarmers. That was Johnny Knoxville, and we're actually in Knoxville, so it's appropriate I should.
No. Benchwarmers was Rob Schneider.
Benchwarmers was Rob Schneider, but The Ringer. That was
the Ringer.
Johnny Knoxville,
yes,
movie
that,
where he pretended
yeah.
to be mentally handicapped.
So I actually like The Ringer a lot.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. It's not a terribly clever movie, but it's a fun movie.
But is it self-aware? Is that
yeah? It is. And okay. I like. It's definitely a highly offensive premise, but I really do think that they tried to handle it without like making like people with handicap, like with disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think they try to do it in a way that like they're not being made like the punchline in it.
Oh, okay.
Like yeah.
like the Farrelly brothers, the way they treat like
and the. Most of that movie, like, the idea is the jokes aren't, hey, these people are retarded. The joke is, wow, Johnny Knoxville is a gigantic piece of shit for pretending for pretending to be disabled to win a fucking Special Olympics.
Not with those Rob Schneider movies, though.
Oh, Jesus Christ, Rob Schneider. What the fuck? The other thing I would say, there are so many unnecessary scenes now from a story standpoint where the purpose of the scene seems to be to say, Mel Gibson's wacky, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, realistically, at this point, Like, I think the Christmas tree scene could have just shown that he was reckless, and been a little bit shorter and not ended in the confrontation that it did. But then we get the scene where he jumps off the roof with the jumper.
Oh, I forgot about that.
And it was like, so that's like three scenes in the space of 20 minutes where it's just like, all right, we get it. Mel Gibson is fucking batshit insane.
Didn't that guy committing suicide realize that there's a giant inflatable?
I think the whole like function of that, when Mel Gibson just distracts him to keep him from looking down.
Yeah.
And they can inflate one of those. I mean, I'm not trying to like argue for the plausibility of a scene in Lethal Weapon, but I think that's like why he was trying to distract him.
Yeah.
And then he got the cuff on him. And then by that point, they had the inflatable thing.
Well, and then also on top of that, like, if they were inflating that, that guy easily could have just ran to the corner and jumped off the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Whereas Mel Gibson guided him down to it.
I feel like the LAPD is probably like, well, Mel Gibson plays by his own rules, but at least he doesn't kill black people.
Yeah!
There's more than you can say about Gary Busey.
Yeah, oh man, Gary Busey. Just shooting cops left and right.
Yeah, he does not care.
Oh, God. And then, like, Murtaugh, who just, like, is supposed to be, like, the CO between the two of them, really. Like, the senior officer and everything. He fucking, like, after Mel Gibson jumps off a roof and he realizes, oh, maybe he's crazy. What's the best way to handle this? Oh, I'll fucking provoke him and put a gun in his hand and tell him to kill himself.
The conveniently located, like, abandoned storefront right across the street from the, from the crime scene.
Well, then he keeps
talking
about
it. Just walk into it.
Don't put it against your head. Put it in your mouth. Pull my miss and go through your ear.
When has that ever happened? That is...
like that's Fight Club.
Oh, yeah.
He just shoots himself out the side of his cheek. But, yeah, like, the senior officer is like, just none of these are the way that you should handle this situation.
Well, it didn't seem like Danny Glover was really effective in anything that he did.
Not until the end, no.
When they had their own Fight Club.
But he takes out General McAllister.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Although, I don't know why he just took one shot. I was like, just shoot both of them. Also,
his family also... His entire family also sees his dick while he's in the back.
Yeah! That's our introduction. Oh, Danny Glover with a beard. This is a splendid little treat. Oh, the bubbles have faded. His family gets to see a shrunk dick.
Here's your cake. Happy birthday, Dad.
I know what you should wish for, Dad. A little more length.
Now, while we're on the subject of Danny Glover and his family, I think this can weave into the incredibly cocaine-drenched soundtrack.
Yeah, the saxophones.
Yeah, it's basically straight what we equate with 80s porn music.
Yep.
Like, the saxophone from, like, Careless Whisper.
Yep.
That Jerry Rafferty likes. Yeah, Miami Vice. That kind of shit. And they have, like, a really sensual, like, saxophone line that happens when we meet Danny Glover's 17-year-old daughter.
Yeah.
He's like, this is my senior prom dress. And
yep.
She kisses him on the cheek, and you just hear, I'm like, Jesus Christ. There's
and
sensual
look isn't like, the look on his face isn't like, oh, my God, my daughter, like, some guy's going to plow her on the prom night. It's like, man, I wish I could plow my daughter on the prom night.
Oh. Oh. All right, so there's incest, racism.
Yep.
There's trying to think. Are there any other horrible other than letting certain scenes? There's also the porno guitar. There's like the saxophone and like the guitar.
It's Eric
Clapton,
man.
Yeah, it is Eric Clapton.
And the studio band is called, what are they called?
Hollywood Suite
sang A Lethal Weapon. And I don't know.
Bob Seger original.
I don't know if they did the rest of it, but they definitely have the closing credit song.
They probably did a good majority of the songs in the movie.
Yeah,
that sounds like studio musicians. That
worked
for Warner Brothers.
Yeah. It's crazy.
No,
it
didn't.
There's
no way.
It did. ZZ Top did the score for Lethal Weapon 3.
Yeah.
Eric Clapton did the score for that.
Yeah.
I wasn't joking.
It was the 80s. Eric Clapton sucked by the 80s, dude.
He sucked by the time he turned, like, 23. But,
well, there you go.
Yeah, no, it's his music, Michael Kamen, and Eric Clapton. All right.
Yeah.
4-1 for Kolar.
Yeah.
That's where the cocaine comes from.
Eric Clapton and Michael Kamen of Metallica's S&M album.
That was really?
Yeah, that's yeah, yeah. Michael came and conducted the orchestra that did that album with them. And then he died a couple years ago, actually, as punishment for his crimes against music with his All right. Hey, what do you think if we set some violins to anything post Master of Puppets? I won't be killed and struck down in my twilight years for this, will I? the other things were that Riggs and Murtaugh's blatant disregard for the safety of the civilian populace the entire movie.
Well, that's also like one of the staples of every buddy cop movie.
I feel like it's really bad in this one. Yeah. Murtaugh shoots the driver of a car that can only possibly continue down the alley into oncoming traffic and a civilian populace center.
Had to kill the general, though, man. He had his daughter.
He should have just shot both of them.
Yeah, that really doesn't mean
anything. Or, I don't know, when he hands his daughter off to a cop, you know, 20 minutes ago, say, hey, get every available unit to converge on this location so we can stop this without further bloodshed and damage to the civilian population.
I think it was Riggs just rubbing off on him.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, and then Riggs pumping half a clip of an AR into an engine block. And Gary Busey just careening down the freeway.
Well, I think you have, I mean, look at, Beverly Hills Cop was 5 years prior to this.
Yeah, yeah.
Axel Foley blows up half of Detroit in the first 5 minutes of the movie.
That's Detroit, no one will notice.
In 1980, yeah, even by 82, that's a funny thing about Beverly Hills Cop is that, like, even in 82, that was, like, the go-to, like, shitty city.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that was 32 years ago, and now they're paying people to live in Detroit.
Yeah. Hey, you want to move in here with these coyotes and bears who just kind of found their way into the town? But, yeah, there's so much of it. I get the other thing, we got to talk about the fight at the end of the movie. We can't not talk about that before we wrap up. 30 cops on the scene, and they have him dead to rights. They get his weapon away. All they gotta do is slap on the cuffs, and Riggs just goes, "I want a shot at the title." So they have a street fight on the front lawn of a house.
But before this happens, they lure him into Danny Glover's house.
Yeah, and then throw a cop car through the wall. Yeah, of the house.
Through his own house. That's their distraction. Not just, I don't know, maybe have 30 cops waiting inside the house.
I feel like Gary Busey would have killed them all somehow.
Yeah, Gary Busey's too smart for that.
Yeah. That's true. That's very true.
But I just love how they basically take the cop car from the cops that he had just killed.
Yeah.
Like while he was driving up to Murtaugh's house. They take the car from them. They basically that meant that they pulled the bodies out of the car.
I don't know if they pulled the bodies out.
Where the body? But you see, looks like
I don't. I don't think you can. I don't.
No, because he opened it up. Oh. He opened up the door because there was nobody in there.
Oh man,
like
it would be funnier if they just left the dead cops in there. Yeah. Hey, you guys.
One last.
You guys using this?
One last act of heroism. Yeah. Your bodies are gonna like
propel serve and protect, boys. All right, I'm gonna put the cinder block on the pedal.
It's a pretty intense fight, though.
Yeah, it's a great fight. It's an amazing fight scene. It's a lot of fun. But again, yeah, all these cops, at no point does a superior officer, a captain, or anything show up on the scene to say, hey, you're cops, what the fuck are you doing? Yeah. Street fighting on the lawn.
Danny Glover took control.
He said, blame me.
And then he also said, just don't let any civilians get close.
Yeah, the one time, like...
In the suburban neighborhood.
Yeah, like, don't let any of the straights wander on over here and get outside crescent kicked by Gary Busey.
And also, we forgot to mention that when Gary Busey shoots these cops, their car flies into a fire hydrant, creating a wonderful, like, ambient backdrop for this entire fight scene.
Oh, yeah, fighting in the rain.
I was curious about that, too, because they were parked, right? And then Gary Busey drove up to them, and they flipped their lights
on.
So they were parked, and all of a sudden they got shot, and the car just drove into...
First day on the job.
This is the only day that I'm going to argue any kind of justification. I think they were actually, like, actively cruising, and, like, they stopped when Gary Busey rolled up.
I don't think they threw it in the park.
Popped his foot on the brake, just like, oh, let's see what this guy's going to do. Surely we're not going to get ventilated like Swiss cheese. Excuse me, sir. Hey, you look a lot like the guy that played Richie Valens in that movie. sorry, it was Buddy Holly. Lou Diamond Phillips was Richie Valens. My bad.
Yeah.
They all died on the same plane. Same difference. All right, let's go around. What I like to do at the end is wrap it up with everybody's favorite moment from the movie. So, Michael, what was yours?
Thanks for starting over there.
Yeah, God, you really put me on the spot here, Dustin. I have to say the fight scene at the end, it was just too ridiculous.
Pretty badass.
Yeah, or Mel Gibson's racist remarks. Toss up.
In real life, not in the movie.
Yeah.
Riggs
is racist remarks.
Yeah, I think I'd say fight scene too, but I also like the helicopter chase. With the helicopter
in the desert,
like,
where it just keeps
knocking on the door.
Just keeps hitting the car. Just keeps hitting it with the landing struts.
Because I thought, oh, maybe the helicopter's going to land on this limo. That'd be crazy.
Yeah.
It didn't happen, but...
It tried.
That would have been my favorite.
Also, that entire scene, while Murtaugh's daughter is driving the limo away with, like, a dead body in the passenger seat.
Yeah.
The whole time, like, she's speeding along and the helicopter's, like, right overhead. I'm just like, just slam the brakes on. A helicopter can't brake that quickly.
Yeah.
Like...
She's a woman driver.
Hey, it's her first day on the job.
It was her first day on the job as a damsel in distress.
Take her down to work day.
As a hostage. That's what I was going to say. And of course, Mel Gibson. We all know. In 98, Ransom became one of his biggest hits with his now classic line, "Give me back my son."
Yeah.
So he's been in many hostage-related movies.
Yeah, I
think that scene was great. The whole like way that they set him up with a sniper rifle to take out like half of Gary Busey's crew. I like the scene. I'm always a big fan of like in action movies where you obviously know that the good guys aren't going to die, but like there's that one scene where the bad guys are torturing them.
Yeah,
but like, you know, Danny Glover's in one room getting like his ass beat
by the old bad guy.
Yeah, they're salting his wounds, and then they're electroshocking. That's when who's the actor?
Al Leong.
Al Leong is like electroshocking Mel Gibson, and then Mel Gibson manages to like fool them into thinking that, well, he's like hanging from a meat hook this whole time.
Yeah, yeah.
There's always meat hooks. Like in every like bad guy hideaway, there's always like meat hooks that they just can.
Oh, that's one of the first things. Yeah. I'm not crazy about the carpet, but we'll let it slide. We're gonna need some meat hooks, though.
We're gonna need to torture some people.
Why didn't they kill them just off the bat?
They wanted to find out if they talked to anyone else, basically.
Ah.
That was literally the entire reason they didn't just kill them in the desert.
Yeah.
Because they knew that Hunsaker had talked to them.
Hunsaker.
But they wanted to find out that if they had told anyone else in their department, which would have been the smart thing to do. So of course they didn't tell anyone else in the department.
But yeah, that scene too, now that we're talking about Hunsaker, the father of the woman who kills herself. I think that scene with the helicopter where Gary Busey's like in the helicopter and the helicopter just sort of appears out of nowhere.
Yeah, it's so silent.
And just... And suddenly he's made into Swiss cheese.
Yeah.
And his eggnog starts.
Yeah. What does the eggnog symbolize? There had to have been Christmas.
The loss of
innocence. Oh, yeah. And there's also a multi-millionaire who just has a bunch of cartons of eggnog sitting in his office.
Yeah, he can afford it.
Yeah. But no, he just has him sitting on a desk. Like, it doesn't seem like there's going to be a party. He just has, like, he drinks 16 eggnogs by himself in his office.
Hey, he's grieving, man. Let him drink what he wants. I love that the helicopter appears much like the bus in the first Final Destination movie, where you never hear it, then just bam, someone gets hit by a bus out of left field. Oh, man. Those are all some solid moments. I think mine is pretty much that entire sequence when they're still in the club after they get captured, after Riggs kills Al Leong, mm-hmm. and then just bust in the room and just start shooting the shit out of people.
Yeah.
And then the one guy runs up to him in the club, implied to be a bad guy, but with Riggs' short temper and like immediate response time, could just as easily have been a random person in the club that he just ventilated for no reason.
Yeah, there has to be a club scene. If you're going to do an 80s action movie and it has anything to do with LA, there has to be a club scene that is in the club that's run by the bad guys.
Yeah.
They always have a club. Like, there's no bad guys who are shitty entrepreneurs in 80s movies. Like, they're always people who have fronts that are so good.
Yeah.
They could just make the money off of the front
and
not have to deal heroin anymore.
We could go legit? Yeah. No. Well, even in The Wire, even in West Baltimore, they've got clubs as fronts. So it's good to see that some things never change.
The king stay the king.
Exactly. It's all part of the game.
Yeah.
So I think that's a 5-episode streak of mentioning The Wire in the episode so far. So I'm doing pretty good.
And Rob Schneider.
Yeah.
Cool. Surprise. Say, hell yeah, I know Marlo. All right.
I think that's going to do it for us. Thanks, Mike Kolar, for being my guest host.
Yeah.
And thank you, Michael Myers and Tyler Sonicson, for being on.
Thank you, Dustin.
No problem. And we'll catch you all next time.
Join us next time as I take Matt Montith and Arnold Schwarzenegger's action film Commando, all leading up to this month's Struck a Nerve to Pop Culture mixtape on August 18th at Wild Goose Creative right here in Columbus, Ohio. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, like the page on Facebook, send any comments, questions to the show at hellhavenotseenthispodcast@gmail.com, and we'll catch you next time.